If you go into a GCSE age classroom today, nearly half of kids will not be living with both natural parents. Now, I think that's horrendous. I think that's appalling.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the UK's leading Christian magazine, and it brings you this show each and every week. Right here on The Profile, I'm delighted to say that my guest this week is the research director of the Marriage Foundation, Harry Benson. Harry is the author of a number of books, including What Mums Want and Dads Need to Know. And we're speaking because this month is a special edition of Premier Christianity. It is February, Valentine's Day, and we're looking at the topic of family and relationships through a number of different articles in this month's magazine. But one of the main features is this interview with Harry. We're so looking forward to hearing from Harry Benson today. Harry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for asking me, Sam.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Now, before we start talking about your work with the Marriage Foundation, can I take you back to the 1980s? Because I understand that you were one of the youngest helicopter pilots to serve in the Falklands War, and you later wrote a book about it called Scram. Just tell me a little bit about what that experience was like.
Wow. Well, I went more or less straight into the Navy after I left school. And then the training pipeline was pretty quick in those days. And so 2.5 years later, I found myself as a frontline commando pilot at the Royal Naval Air Station at Yeovilton. We got sent off to Northern Ireland for our first tour. And while that was happening, Galtieri invaded the Falklands in April 1982. And so we all got summoned, and all of the pilots, all of us air crew, commando air crew, ended up in the Falklands, more or less without exception. I was just 21 at that stage. I think there were six of us. We worked out there were about six 21-year-old pilots. So we sailed off there. We got down there. It took a month to get there, so it seemed to take forever. We could have swum faster because the ship was so slow. And so we were there for the last 10 days of a three-week war. So it was very short, three-week land war. Got lots of action into the bargain. And so I ended up flying people and stuff onto the front line, picking up casualties under fire. I came under very heavy artillery fire a number of times. Although I was much more scared of being attacked by enemy aircraft, but that was basically it. So I was 21. I was invincible. And since that time, I guess I've always known that 21-year-olds, if you wind them up and point them in the right direction, they're capable of incredible things. And when one hears a lot about people looking down at the youth of today, so to speak, I think if you train people, they can be incredible at an incredibly young age. And that was, I guess, one of the biggest lessons that the Falklands left me with.
Yeah, important lesson for sure. And you've had a very varied career, because from there, I understand you went into finance. You worked in Asia for a time. You did a degree in psychology. And now you're working in this whole area of family and marriage. At what point in that journey did the Christian faith come into the picture for you?
Well, you'd be not terribly surprised to know that I wasn't a Christian when I went to war. And I having become a Christian 10 years later, I still to this day find it quite difficult to reconcile faith and military, although I'm still very well connected with the current military and my ex-military colleagues. But having said that, I don't regret what I did. It was part of my life. It's what's the path that God took me on at the time. And I became a Christian some years later in Hong Kong at a very wacky church, led by a woman pastor called Jackie Pullinger, who's quite well known.
She previous guest on this show is Jackie Pullinger. We had a great chat 3 years ago. Yeah. A formidable lady, I think it's fair to say.
I'm much less terrifying than she is or was. My wife and I were going through a big marital crisis, and we drifted apart, which is a very classic thing that happens to young couples after they've had the first one or two children. That you end up drifting into these sort of typical roles of mom and dad. mum staying at home doing all the kids and dad going off and doing all the work and earning the money. And we drifted apart. We stopped being friends. And while we were putting this thing back together again, mysteriously the Lord intervened and I got sucked into this whirlpool. My wife had become a Christian and she had friends of hers were missionaries for Jackie in her church called Hangfoot Camp. And they were looking after young teenage drug addicts and whatever. And I thought, my goodness, they're giving out love in a way that I don't understand where they get their fuel from. So I wanted to follow them out of curiosity because I wanted that kind of love in my marriage, which at that point had been great fun, but not terribly romantic, I guess. And so I wanted proper love. I wanted to know how to love my wife, which sounds ridiculous because I thought I was reasonably coherent and intelligent and capable. But I was obviously failing in the relationship from. And so I followed them and a whole bunch of weird events happened, which knocked me out of my comfort zone and surprised me. And one day on the 8th of January 1995, I got walloped in a sort of road to Damascus experience. It was just very crystal clear. Closed my eyes during one of Jackie's services. I was there. It was the fourth time I'd been to her weird church with 500 wonderful Chinese people who are mostly ex-addicts or street sleepers or prostitutes or whatever, and a few little expats like me. And she stopped the service halfway through and she said, there's someone here who needs to meet Jesus right now. And it's very embarrassing. So all stand up and close your eyes. And whoever it is, put your hands out and receive a gift. And as I walked through the whatever prayer she prayed, I went from this sort of very arid, clear, arid desert across a huge chasm with a sort of Mickey Mouse type rope bridge. And then there was luscious tropical jungle on the other side. And as I got halfway across the bridge broke and I was suddenly going from death to life. It was a very vivid picture and I can still see it now, even, you know, however many years on, 30 years on. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. I had no idea what happened, of course. It took me a while to figure out that I'd become a follower in that moment. But it was an extraordinary privilege to have a Damascus-like experience rather than the sort of slow, fuzzy thing or being born into it that I think a lot of people have.
That's so interesting that your journey through Jackie Pullinger was accompanied by what you call these weird experiences, these miraculous experiences. Because just for those who don't know the story, Jackie Pullinger's quite famous, well known for leaving the UK, getting on a boat that would stop at lots of different places, praying and asking God where to get off. She got off in Hong Kong in the walled city, which, as you say, huge amount of prostitution, drug addiction. And the story's become very well known of her, of, for example, people on heroin coming off heroin through speaking in tongues and not having withdrawal symptoms, which in terms of crazy, weird, far out there stories, it doesn't get much bigger than that. What were the weird things happening to you? Because that was not your background. You're not Chinese. You were drugs, as far as I'm aware, but weird stuff was still happening. What was the supernatural that was going on for you?
Although I was brought up in a very traditional school setting where we went to chapel every day for 10 years and I basically hated it. It was just religion and it was nonsense. And I knew God didn't exist. I was asking Kate one night over dinner, so what does this God sound like that you claim to know? And I was being a bit sarcastic about it. And I closed my eyes. And as I closed my eyes, the words Judges 6 came into my head. And I thought, oh, that's a random reference to something Bible-ish, because we're talking Bible-ish. And I couldn't think of anything else at all. All I could think of was Judges 6. And it rattled around my brain. And I said it to Kate and she got very excited and rushed off and got a Bible. And it's the story of Gideon who hears from God, but doesn't know whether he's heard from God. And so he says, I tell you what, I'll put a fleece out, a sheepskin out outside my front door. And if it's wet in the morning when the ground is dry, then I'll believe you. And that's not quite enough. So he then puts out, he says, I want it to be dry and the ground's wet. And anyway, he then becomes a great leader. Anyway, that doesn't necessarily follow for me, but the point is it was an interesting example of hearing from God. But I thought this is just a random thing. Anyway, about 20 minutes later, Kate's going to bed and she's reading a book by a writer called John White. And she's on page 124 or something like that. And turns to the top of page 124, the first line she reads is, if you want to hear from God, look no further than Gideon's experience in Judges 6, which at which point she screams at me, Harry, I've had a revelation. then tells me, and I say, hang on a second, I had the revelation here. This was mine. So we went to a thing on Boxing Day with Kate's missionary friends. This is the first time I'd been to Jackie's church. And they handed out turkey and rice to 3,000 grannies. And I thought this was really cool. So I stood on one of the trestle tables dishing out turkey and rice into little takeaway boxes to, you know, a whole load of grannies coming past. The table next to us suddenly stopped doing anything and they were all holding hands. And I said to the guy next to me, I said, what are they doing? He said, oh, they're praying that God will provide because we've run out of turkey. You know, why don't they go and look for some? And they said, well, there isn't any. They've completely run out. The next thing I know, there's this huge cheer and this table next to us is piled high with turkey. And they say, look, God's provided. Anyway, I was so curious about this. I thought, that's weird. It must have come from somewhere. And so I went into the little kitchen area they had and I said, where did this stuff come from? I was asking around. And they said, you have no idea. We'd run out. There wasn't any. And then suddenly it was there. We don't know where it came from, who delivered it, how it happened. Absolutely amazing. And that kind of freaked me out as well. I've always called it the magic turkey ever since. Well, there we go. How can you not become a Christian when you hear about these things?
How can you not become a Christian after magic turkeys? I mean, come on. Zach, what more would it take, right? Even for a rational person, there comes a moment you think, now, oh, come on, there's something else going on here. Fascinating.
Exactly.
Well, it's a great story. Now, already in your story, you mentioned that you and your wife hit a bit of a rough spot after kids sort of drifting apart a little bit. And that is the story, I guess, for many couples, isn't it? That that marriage can have its ups and downs and it can be challenging. You're now working with the Marriage Foundation and I assume that a lot of your work is motivated by your own personal experience. So I'd love just to hear a little bit more of that story of where things were tricky or went a bit wrong in your own marriage, how you resolved that, and I guess how that's now really led to a passion to work in this entire area of research into marriage and really flying the flag, banging the drum, whatever analogy you want to use for why marriage is so important in today's society and why we all need to be backing it more.
Mm. Well, I am very motivated by marriage as a godly idea. I'm motivated because I managed to dig myself out of a hole, or Kate and I managed to dig ourselves out of a hole, from which we would not have escaped had we not been married. We're pretty clear about that. The fact that we were married gave us just enough breathing room to give us a chance to escape. And so I'm motivated by that, by a bit of this, the faith stuff and my personal experience. But equally, I actually, amazingly enough, care about the wider society. And we live at a time of the highest rate of family breakdown there's ever been in recorded UK history. If you go into a GCSE age classroom today, nearly half of kids will not be living with both natural parents. Now, I think that's horrendous. I think that's appalling. It's way higher than it should be. Half of our kids experience family breakdown in one shape or form. You can accept that there should be some level of family breakdown. Some level of family breakdown, most reasonable people would agree, is sensible because human beings can be horrid to one another. There can be abuse, there can be addiction, there can be abandonment, there can be adultery, all sorts of things. And I don't know whether it's 5 or 10 or 15 or whatever, but 45 to 50, it's really, really high. And the driver of that has been the trend away from marriage. And ultimately, that motivates me a great deal. Is this true that it's marriage that's making the difference? And why is it that's the case? And that's really what's driven my current project, which is my PhD on the psychology of marriage, and looking at does it matter whether you marry before, during, or after pregnancy? And the answer is it doesn't make an awful lot of difference. The most important thing is that you get married because there's so much psychology built in. My parents split up. I lived in a pretty privileged upbringing. I went to boarding school. We were very comfortable all our lives. But my father left home when I was 3 and I hardly saw him in the years after that until he died in the early 2000s. So for 40 something years, I saw my father maybe twice a year. So I was ultimately brought up by my mother. And most of that was frankly being sent away to boarding school. But, you know, we never really had a terribly intimate relationship, and she would have been the first to have admitted that. So I went through boarding school pretty closed, but also very capable. And I became a helicopter pilot, and then I went into finance and did okay in that. But it was always better not to feel. And so I was very emotionally closed. So how I met Kate, I met her, I was on a naval course at the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. I was on a staff course. How she fell for me and we got together is still a mystery because I was so emotionally closed. But I guess she saw that I was trustworthy and honest and decent and loyal and all that sort of thing. A lot of things that that military people have and ex-boarding school boys are pretty straightforward, but not great at relationships. And so we had a lot of fun. We got married at 25 and 22. I was 25, she was 22. We moved out to Asia. I stopped my naval career. We went out to Asia, lived in Hong Kong and Bangkok. And we had a fantastic time, but we weren't really great friends. And we were quite functional as a couple and as ultimately as parents. But we were not, we didn't operate well as in terms of intimacy. I'd never really experienced it before. And that's my excuse, but it just wasn't a feature of our lives, was deep friendship and intimacy. And I think having children brings this to a head because mums very often get into the habit, having had 9 months of pregnancy, of thinking, you know, I'm thinking baby, baby, baby. And so you're ahead of the husband, head of the father, father figure in terms of thinking about how you're going to handle the baby. So it's very easy for mum naturally to take over the running of the show when children are born. And for dad kind of get pushed into the background because mum, if you get it wrong, then mum says it's easier if I do it myself. Very gradually and very slowly and very sort of surreptitiously almost, we drifted apart. And we stopped talking to each other. We found it difficult to have even a 5-minute conversation with one another. We had our first 2 children and we had some ups and downs in my business life at that time. Eventually, Kate became a Christian through a whole other sequence of events. And eventually she confronted me. I got called in for a meeting with her and her church leader and his wife, and who were wonderful. And they sat me down and it was like a bolt from the blue to hear that Kate said, if you don't get your marriage sorted out within the next year, it's going to be over. So I had no idea what that meant. I didn't see it coming, but I just knew I needed to do something about it. And my first reaction was to try and keep the marriage going for the sake of the kids, which ultimately is for the sake of me. It wasn't really to do with Kate. So I still hadn't got it. I hadn't got the point of marriage. I just thought it was all about me or all about the kids. And so I ended up getting sent to counselling against my better judgment, but I did it because friends said we should go there. We had smart friends. Wise friends is really a key to getting any marriage back on the tracks, having wise friends around who can give you the sort of steps to take. And one of the steps, they said, Harry, you're so closed, you're borderline psychotic. I thought I wore that as a badge of honor. Anyway, I marched off to counseling and I had the most fabulous therapist who basically got me to open up the tin of worms and start being angry and upset about my childhood experience of abandonment at boarding school, which is what it felt like to me. That's obviously not what my parents had done, but that's what it felt like. And I started to gain a vocabulary of emotions, and that was absolutely wonderful. I then, after that, so that was fantastic, but it didn't really help our marriage. I then met these Christian missionaries that Kate was with, and these odd things happened when I became a Christian. That didn't help our marriage either, because I don't think Jesus does actually particularly help you. What he does do is he switches the lights on so that you can see what's going on in the world. And that's what he did for me. And we finally confronted the problem. The ultimate confrontation was about 6 months after Kate had sort of said, we've got to sort ourselves out. 6 months later, we had a dual counseling session, and she burst into tears with my counselor. And I didn't know what to do. I was like a rabbit in the headlights. And my counselor, my friend, said to me, come on, Harry, do something. And I had no idea what to do, not a clue. And so that meeting was awful. I had to go back to work. And by the time I got home in the evening, there was a letter waiting for me from Kate, a sort of job spec of what it was to be Harry's wife. So terms and conditions, hours, pay, you know, all that sort of things. But at the end of it, she said, look, what I really need is a friend. And will I ever get that? who knows and who cares. And who cares was written in capital letters. And it really shocked me to the core. So those two words, who cares, really turned around our marriage because it forced me to confront, what have I done wrong? What on earth have I done to this wife of mine? And so I got down on my knees to Kate, literally on my knees for the second time, first time being proposal. And the second time was when I said, you've got no reason to believe that I will change, but I will. And I did. And somehow a switch clicked in my head where I realized, now I need to do this for the sake of Kate and not just for the kids or me.
Yeah, and it sounds like from that, a big key was this idea of friendship. And it strikes me as very interesting that even when you went through counselling and unlocked perhaps the ability to emote or to express your feelings, you said actually that didn't necessarily fix it. Even becoming a Christian, although that was life-changing and wonderful, didn't immediately overnight fix your marriage. You're sort of painting a picture here that actually it does take work. It can take years. There's quite a lot of habits and things to change. But ultimately, in your story, there's hope. There's hope that a marriage can completely be turned around.
There's great hope. And it really was a question of, at some point, realizing that I needed to make this mental shift. And it's not a very big mental shift. And I suspect most marriages and even most cohabiting relationships that are going downhill and drifting apart. And let's face it, drifting apart is by far the biggest cause of relationship breakup. I mean, it's not, divorces are not acrimonious by and large. Few of them, some are, but most of them are just sort of, oh, well, yeah, okay, then off you go. And you've stopped talking to each other, you've fallen out of love, all that sort of thing. But I think that for most people, the solution actually ultimately is usually the man as well, needs to make a mental shift to focus his priority on his wife, put his wife first, and effectively do that Jesus bit that it says in Ephesians 5, you know, husbands, love your wife as Jesus loved us. How does Jesus love us? He sticks out his arm and he says, come with me, you know, he doesn't take control over us. He doesn't dominate us. He waits for us. He's patient with us. He sacrifices for us. He loves us. He's very unconditional. And I think that's a fantastic model for male life, really, male family life. And that ultimately, that was the insight that we wrote about in What Mums Want and Dads Need to Know, which came to my
your book. Life down. Lay your life down, yeah, for your wife.
Exactly. Getting your priorities sorted, actually. Put your wife first. Husband, love your wife, and then she will love you back. It definitely works. It seems so terribly unfair to say, oh, no, in our age of equality, we've all got to be, it's all going to be 50-50. No, no, no. You've got to step up and do it. And when you do it, you get it back in spades. You get it back big time.
So interesting. You've just said a moment ago, most couples, when they divorce, they talk about growing apart as opposed to it being necessarily some massive argument or being particularly acrimonious. I was reading something you'd written, and you've written before, most couples who end up divorcing do so because they've grown apart, which is what you just said. But then you write, that's a pretty pathetic excuse, which is strong words. I mean, why do you put that so strongly, that it's a pathetic excuse to say you've grown apart?
I think if you don't have children, then, you know, fill your boots and do what you like. Your relationship is entirely your business and has very little impact on the wider world at large, other than that you may be very lovely to have around as a couple. But if you've got children, the game changes and you've got a wider responsibility. You've got to try and make it work. And making it work for the sake of the children, actually, ultimately, that might be your starting motivation, just as it was for me. It is the right thing to do. But if you really want to make it work for the sake of the kids, you really want to get your own marriage back. You want a new, or you want a new marriage that is better than the one you had before. And you can have that, but you need to apply the right sorts of principles. And they are things like how your attitude towards one another. How do you see one another? How do you see your future together? This is commitment in a nutshell. You know, what does your life, what does your future look like together? Are you on this journey together? And then how are you going to treat each other during that journey? Are you going to put each other down, which is kind of the number one relationship red flag? Or are you going to build each other up and treat each other with kindness and tolerance and respect and whatever, and forgiveness and sacrifice? You know, when you've got a long-term view, one of the things the research talks about a lot is that forgiveness and sacrifice allow us to be human beings and to make the kind of mistakes that human beings naturally make without it essentially trashing our relationship. So I'm obviously not saying, you know, go off and sleep with other people, but I'm saying that if you have a harsh word or you say something wrong, then we need to forgive one another. And that doesn't mean forgetting, by the way. That means that the biblical principle about forgiveness is not about forgetting. It's about not remembering. You choose not to bring up the past. That's really important. And you can look up some good biblical stuff about that. Jeremiah is quite good on this. But where God says, I choose not to remember your sins. And that's a great example of forgiveness. But it only comes, you can only do forgiveness and sacrifice, which means that you're not point scoring, you're not keeping track of who did what. But you can only do that if you've got a sense of a long future together, which kind of brings you onto the whole marriage idea, which is that really only marriage gives you that idea that we're going to spend a life together. That's the plan. It doesn't always work. And we all know that. But if you start off with that plan, it gives you your best possible chance of treating each other with kindness and friendship.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99. You mentioned a moment ago this idea of staying together for the children, which my impression is maybe a generation or two ago that was seen as a very worthy and important thing, and I get the impression today that there's less of that concern or desire to have to do that. I think I'm not the first person to point out we live in quite an individualistic society of kind of you do you and whatever works for you and be kind to yourself and put yourself first. Those sorts of phrases, I think, can have an impact. And perhaps there's less of a concern or desire to stay together for the sake of children. But the question I wanted to ask you, because you've actually done research on this, is if, sadly, a married couple do decide to split, what is the effect on those children? Because the research and statistics around this are quite shocking, I think, and aren't particularly well known. That well, you tell me what the outcomes are for children if mum and dad don't stay together.
Well, first of all, this is the experience of half of families in Britain will either have or do or will split up at some stage, and most of that is driven today by unmarried families that have never married. So there hasn't been a sense of formal commitment in the first place. The starting point is, when you split up, is that your resources become very heavily stretched. And many couples end up trying to live the same life, but in two different places. And they very quickly end up finding themselves, their ends don't meet. You get into poverty. And, you know, you only got to look at the sort of welfare statistics where the proportion couples who split up who are on welfare is vastly higher than those who are actually still in intact couples. And it's kind of obvious, really. Two pairs of hands is easier than one, just from a money, pure resource management point of view. But then you've also got managing children. You may think you're getting divorced, but you're not really, because you've still got to look after your kids. And you've still got to find some way of making your relationship work to some degree, at least, in order to make things work for the kids. Most people who end up as lone parents don't end up in that position by choice. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's something that's happened. It's not the dream. And most lone parents do an amazing job. I have several in my own family. I was brought up by a lone parent. My sister's a lone parent. She's an amazing lone parent. One of my daughters, actually, oddly enough, this is not a great example, but there we are. This is real life. One of my daughters is an absolutely brilliant lone parent. She's incredible and inspirational, but it's not the dream. It's just not the dream. And ultimately, for the child, even if you can survive the collapse in resources that you have when families split up, even if you can deal with the pressure on the residential parent to be an absolutely brilliant superstar, super mum, or occasionally super dad. Even if you can get past that, you've still got to deal with the child's perception. And children tend to do better counterintuitively if their parents were fighting before they split up, which is the minority of splits. It's the ones where it wasn't obvious, i.e. these are the drifting apart relationships, which is most of them, where kids just don't get it. It comes out of the blue. You know, what on earth happened there? And the classic way that you can then internalize that as a child is if you see your mum and dad split up for no apparent reason, is there are only two possible explanations. One is that that's the nature of relationships. They just go pot for no apparent reason. So that trashes your future for starters, because you've sabotaged your own belief about what relationships can be. The alternative is it was me, my fault, I did it. And that also sabotages your future relationship. And I've heard loads of people sort of verbalize or even, you know, act out this particular scenario where they just didn't see it coming, and they can't trust because they just don't know whether things are going to go pop. So children's perception, you know, you can mitigate an awful lot of this as a lone parent by being a super mum or a super dad, and dealing with the limited resources. And the welfare state's very helpful at the lower end in that respect, but it also traps you. In the end, the sticking point is how a kid's going to take it. And I mean, I'll just give my very simple example. Is that I should be a statistic because my parents split up, but because my family were well off, and I had a privileged upbringing, I should have escaped the effects of lone parenthood, because we never had the poverty thing. I mean, we, you know, there had certainly times when we struggled, but we weren't anywhere near poverty, and so I was shielded from that. But I never had a father figure around. And he was, my dad was a dreadful father. And I loved being with him, but he was an awful father. And my mother wasn't terribly intimate with me. And so, you know, not surprising, my marriage nearly went belly up. And I really can pin it down to that. And I'm not making excuses, because I dealt with it and I've had to deal with it. But that's kind of one of the effects, is that you think, oh, well, people can cope, kids can cope. But just because they can cope doesn't mean you should thrust it upon them. So I think that's it, really. Family breakdown definitely takes families into poverty, definitely makes it hard for families to manage their children, and definitely also alters the viewpoint of their children. And mental health, teenage mental health problems, guess what? Family breakdown is the number one factor. What would you rather your parents would be? Would you rather they actually get on with one another, they make an effort for one another, they're kind, they sacrifice, they're basically wonderful towards each other. They treat each other with kindness, and they're committed to a future together, and they make it work through the inevitable ups and downs. Would you rather that, or would you rather say, well, let's sort of get over it? You know, if the children got a pick, you know which way they're going to go. So we should think the same way insofar as that's possible.
Is this an area where the church is leading the way? Can we say that there's fewer divorces in the church, there's fewer family breakdown in the church, that abuse is more uncommon amongst Christian couples? Are we able to say that statistically, or are we just as bad as everyone else?
I'm afraid it's a really annoyingly difficult question to answer, because in the UK, and this is probably true throughout the Western civilization, is that a lot more people identify as Christians than actually do anything about it. And so
it's often a difficulty when it comes to statistics, isn't it?
It is. So, I mean, even in the surveys that I deal with, and I use very advanced statistics to try and sort of dig out what's going on in what are the factors. 40% of people roughly identify as Christians of some flavor in this country. But probably, I don't know, you probably know better than I do, maybe 1% to 2% of the population actually go to church regularly. There was a brilliant study done about 25 years ago by a couple of Americans, and they found that if you apply the fact that you're married, you apply your faith into your marriage, then it works better. So simply reading the Bible, even possibly praying together and even going to church together, don't necessarily make your marriage better. It's how you see your marriage in terms of, is it God-inspired? Is it sacred? Those were the two phrases they used. And people who viewed their marriage as God-inspired or sacred in any way definitely did a whole lot better. And if you think about that, it's kind of obvious. Jesus said, you know, what God has put together, then don't let anyone separate. And if God is involved in the equation, if God's in your marriage, then you're going to do better. If you're actually actively bringing him into the equation, it's obviously going to work better.
One of the other things Jesus talks about is being us as Christians being salt and light. And my understanding of that has always been salt preserves what is good in a society. And you would hope that Christians in the church would be preserving what is good in terms of marriages and families staying together and resourcing those areas. And I know in many ways the churches are doing wonderful work there. But the statistics you shared earlier are quite shocking, that around half of young people today are not going to have a mum and dad with them at home, for example. So there's definitely more work to be done for the church, because most Christians, again, would believe in the family, believe in marriage, agree with what you're saying, but would say, well, I'm not seeing it potentially in my own church, but certainly in my own community, my own neighborhood, I am seeing a lot of family breakdown. How can the church be salt? How can the church preserve what is good and honor marriage, honor family, and help families? Because no Christian wants to be judgmental and throwing stones. As you said, single mums and single dads often do an incredible job. So none of this is intended in a judgmental way. Nevertheless, statistics are shocking. What can the church do? How can we all be part of the solution?
I think the first and single most important point, and I'm going to say this because I'm research director for Marriage Foundation and I've done a PhD in the psychology of marriage, I'm obviously going to say the number one issue by, you know, coach and horses ahead of everything else is that people should marry. And the reason for it is there's a whole psychology built into the act of marriage. That when you propose, you're making a clear decision to one another, you're making a plan, you're getting on the same page. You're sending an incredible signal of your intent about your future, which there's a huge amount of cost involved in sending that signal, because you're buying into this thing that you're going to do together, and you're excluding all the other possibilities, and you're also adding yourself some hefty exit costs if it all goes horribly wrong. So this marriage is a huge signal of your intent towards one another. So you're not just giving some rubbishy short-term story just to say, look, you're lying through your teeth, but actually you're saying all the right things. This is actually, I'm doing the right things as well. And then the thing about weddings is that there's a psychology of weddings as well, where if you've got people around you patting you on the head and saying, great choice, it's because you're making this massively risky decision to commit to one person and close the door on all the other options, however wonderful they might have been. And you're closing the door forever. That's the plan. And that's a scary choice. I said earlier, I went to the Falklands and I came under very heavy artillery fire, and various other things happened to me which have been fairly nerve-wracking in my military experience. But I can tell you, there was no experience like it when on the morning of my wedding day, when I remember just shaking like a leaf. I had such jelly wobbles about, you know, what it was going to be like. What on earth am I letting myself in for? But as soon as I walked in to the church to get married, even though I wasn't a Christian at the time, but even I got married in a church, my nerves completely disappeared, because you've got all these people saying, great choice, well done. And they're also, of course, you're standing up and saying something which they're holding you to account as well. That's a good thing. So it's affirmation and constraint, accountability. These are good things. And there's actually some really cool research on this from America, a couple of American studies that show that if you have more than 10 people at your wedding, and one study says more than 10, one says more than 50, but you have a number of people at your wedding, that improves your chances of being happy and still together over the next few years. Equally, if you spend more than 15 to 20 grand on your wedding, that reduces your chances. So what you want is a big wedding at lowest possible cost to give yourself the best chance. And the reason for that is you're not putting yourself in debt, but you've got lots of people supporting you on your side. And it's just very difficult to do marriage on your own. So I think the biggest issue for the church is we need to be unequivocally pro-marriage.
Let me just check I'm understanding correctly. So if we're talking about the problem of how to, you know, we want children to be in a stable family with
parents both around, because statistically that's going to give children a much better chance. Now, it's interesting that you say, well, number one thing is to get married. So just to check I'm understanding correctly, the biggest issue for our young people is not necessarily the divorce rate itself. The issue is actually cohabitation of parents who choose not to get married. And you're then arguing that if you choose not to get married, you are more likely to split and your child then not to have both parents at home. So for you, there's something about the actual act of getting married and even having a wedding, which makes it more likely for that child to have a stable family background. Yeah. Is that the argument you're making?
Yeah, I mean, weddings do too. There's two things that getting married does. It either cements an existing level of commitment. So you're already committed to one another, and you may be cohabiting at this point, or you may not, but you're already committed. And getting married just basically dots the I and crosses the T, and it cements your commitment. It acts as a big public statement, hey, this is us. And the other thing is that it actually boosts your commitment. And it does that in a number of ways. But in my PhD, I've written about some of the theories of this, and I'm not going to go into too much detail. But essentially, when you make a decision about something and then act upon it, which is what you're doing when you get married, your subsequent behavior is going to be consistent with the choice that you've made. Otherwise, you're going to think, why did I bother? And so we behave better in order to justify the choice that we've made, the decision and the action that we've made. And there's a whole bunch of research around this.
It makes you want to make your marriage to work because you've gone to the trouble of a wedding. It makes you more committed.
To get married is... It's the best legal document there is, the best and cheapest legal document there is that protects both parties and also cements your plan for the future together in a legal document. It's a brilliant system, and it costs you £100, a couple of visits to the local registrar, and then you can go off and celebrate it in any way, shape or form you want to. The church has ridiculous rules about marriage, and I'm afraid I'm going to say that publicly, whatever anyone thinks, that they're ridiculous rules. And they're outdated.
When you say the church, are you...
I'm talking about if you want to get legally married in a church, or indeed any of the sort of registered religions, so the Jewish religion, Catholics, the same sort of thing, you have to live within some area. But for the Church of England, you have to live within some area of the parish. When my daughter got married a few years ago, she couldn't get married 3 miles down the road. I'm in a rural area because our parish church was much closer. And so what she did was we went to the register office a week earlier. We had a very informal legal ceremony with two witnesses, which was me and my wife. And then they did the wedding they wanted. They had the wedding they wanted in the church. But then the church definitely made the church leader in that case was fabulous. But the church as an institution makes it hard for you to get married. Not to mention the ludicrous thing, and I'm going to go out on a limb again here. You know, during lockdown, you know, we closed the doors of churches. We made marriage incredibly difficult. We had a 61% fall in weddings in 2020. It was the worst fall of any country in Europe because of our draconian, stupid policies, as it turns out. So you can tell which way I go on that whole lockdown debate. But we've lost most of those weddings. We lost 130,000 weddings in that year. And in the last 3 years, we've got data. There's been a sort of overshoot of about 20 to 30. So we've lost over 100,000 couples have not got married because of the wedding rules. And the church was definitely at the forefront of that, institutionally, not individually, of course. There are individual wonderful examples. But I just don't think, I think the church institutionally needs to get its act together and start saying, we have a massive problem with family breakdown. A massive problem of child poverty, and other, you know, teenage mental health problems, all linked very strongly to family breakdown. But people aren't making the link between family breakdown being driven by marriage. You know, even you, Sam, have just talked about, high divorce rates. Divorce rates are not high. They're the lowest they've been since 1970, because the people who are getting married today are are meaning to do it. They're do it going into it intentionally. And so you've got what we'd call more deciders than sliders. People who are going in with great intent rather than actually going in because it's the next step and they're doing it either because of social or pressure or it's the easiest thing to do. People are marrying now very deliberately and very intentionally. And it's not surprising that divorce rates have plummeted as a result. But yet we've still got this paradox that family breakdown is the highest it's ever been in recorded history. You know, of so many kids experiencing it. The driver is people not committing in the first place. We've got to get to grips with this problem.
For Christians listening to this, they might be thinking, well, I've got a non-Christian friend who would say, actually, what's the point in getting married? I live with my girlfriend, we're raising kids. Financially, I can't see any benefit at all actually in getting married. To the contrary, it's going to be a huge expense to get married and to fork out on the cake and the venue and everything else. So how would you help a Christian who's listening to this saying, you know, I don't want to say to my non-Christian friend, get married, Jesus wants you to, because they don't follow Jesus. They're not claiming to be a Christian. What's the kind of secular argument, if you like, for why marriage is so important and why it's worthwhile and it's worth the expense and everything else?
First of all, let's just deal with the expense issue. I mean, it's £100 at the register office and then whatever ceremony you want. And, you know, if you Google, you'll find that they say the average cost of a wedding is $20,000 to $30,000. It isn't. I did an actual survey of a representative sample of married people in the UK. The average, the median point, is somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. That means that half of people are spent more than $5,000 to $10,000. And half spent less on their wedding. So that's much more representative of the reality. I think the biggest reason for doing it, though, is that it brings clarity to your relationship. You know, if you the sort of current zeitgeist is that if you're living with somebody or if you have a child or if you've bought your own place, these are really good signs of commitment. And people, you know, put them high up on surveys as being very important signs of commitment. It's not as high as marriage, but it's pretty close. But it isn't actually, really. It's not, because you're committing to the child or you're committing to the property. You're not really committing to each other. The only way you really commit to each other is by standing in front of each other and saying, darling, do you want to spend the rest of your life with me? Because I would really like to spend the rest of my life with you. And then you go and embarrass yourself in front of your friends by saying, we've agreed that's what we're going to do. That's our plan. We know the world says it doesn't always work, sure, but you're stacking the odds in your favor. And, you know, in my, I'll go back to my PhD thesis that I've just completed. I looked at 3,500 couples whose kids were born in the year 2000. I've taken into account, I followed them over 14 years and to see what happens. And so they're either married or not married at the beginning. And I've looked at the timing of marriage and whether it matters, whether they married before pregnancy, during pregnancy, or after they get after they've had their child. Does it make a difference? The answer is it doesn't make an awful lot of difference, regardless of every background factor you can imagine: age, education, income, ethnicity, happiness, psychological well-being, time together, you know, all these sorts of things. Marriage is still by far the biggest effect on whether you're going to stay together compared to never marrying. So you should do it, and you should be encouraging your friends to get married, because how on earth do you know that you're really committed? Having a baby is not enough, because you can just kind of go with the flow. By going in a flat, you can go with the flow, and you're committing to other things and people. But to actually commit to one another and say to one another, the only way you can do that really is by saying, are you going to spend the rest of your life with me?
Yeah. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk, Harry. I really appreciate your time. I think just through hearing you speak, we've got a really good sense of what the Marriage Foundation is and what you're passionate about. But I wanted to finish by asking you just specifically, because I understand it started with the story of Sir Paul Coleridge. Can you just tell us a little bit about the background to the organisation, to Paul's story, and to how you've become involved in it?
Sure. We started back in April 2012, and it started, I suppose, because I was involved in a relationship project in Bristol. I was teaching couples how to make their relationship work. I was doing it in prison. I was doing it for antenatal and postnatal families, and also for couples getting married, and a bit of parenting as well. And I'd kind of realized that I was pushing water uphill. It was that although that my courses were going very well and they were very popular, ultimately I could make much more of a difference by talking about how people form healthy relationships, how we commit to a good start, how we build strong foundations. And while I was thinking about that, then I had Sir Paul Coleridge, who was then a senior high court judge in the family division, who'd seen just arrays of scenes of devastation in so many cases, very high profile cases. And invariably, it was about either marriages not working or the couples not being married in the first place. And he wanted to do something about it and had this idea of setting up Marriage Foundation as a sort of flag waver for the country. And unbelievably, there isn't one at the moment. There are various marriage organizations around, but no real national flag carrier. So we've kind of rather arrogantly taken that upon ourselves to try and do that in a sensible and all-encompassing way. So we're not speaking to the church particularly. We are, obviously, but we're and a lot of our support comes from the church, but we're mainly speaking to the wider community as a whole, because that's where most people are at. And we started back in 2012. He'd made himself very unpopular because talking about marriage as a high court judge is deemed very controversial because it doesn't go with the sort of zeitgeist of diversity. We struggled, we had to fight to get registered by the Charities Commission. But we basically told them, look, we're the Commitment Foundation, essentially. We're interested in commitment.
It's an absolutely fascinating area. I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to unpack all of the research and statistics. There is lots more, of course, on the Marriage Foundation website, marriagefoundation.org.uk. Do check out my guest, Harry Benson's books on the subject as well. And Harry, we wish you all the very best with the results of your PhD, which are imminent, as I understand it. But thank you for helping us with this special edition of the magazine looking at marriage and relationships. It's been great to talk.
Thanks, Sam.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.